rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Filling in also for Al Franken throughout last week and this on Air America stations all across the United States. Ronald Rollins is with us. He's a retired professor of physical chemistry and author of the book God, the Intelligent Designer. This is a topic that's not going to go away, regardless of, despite a few recent court cases. Kiwi Publishing, Kiwi, K-I-W-E, publishing.com, by the way, the source for that book. And Professor Rollins, welcome to the program. Hello?
Hello, and yes, hello and welcome.
pleased to have you with us. Why is it that you believe that intelligent design should be taught in our public schools?
Because there is so much logic and evidence for it.
And now, one of the points that folks who are on the intelligent design side make is that the theory of evolution is just a theory. But you know, the vulgar meaning of the word theory means, well, maybe not. But the scientific meaning of the word theory is you know, very, very specific. I mean, you know, it is quoting from the dictionary. Scientific, something that has that is testable, grounded in evidence, and able to predict natural phenomena. And you know, why trash evolution?
Because there is much evidence that it is completely false. The evolution, the theory of evolution, started about 150 years ago with our friend Darwin, and the accompanying theory of uniformitarianism from Lyell. And since then, things have gone further and further away from what I call religion and truth. But prior to that, they were in agreement.
It seems like the biggest variation from the theory of evolution that I'm familiar with is the one that was put forward by a professor at Harvard University a few years ago, about two decades ago, of punctuated evolution. The idea that actually evolution happens through a series of bottleneck disaster events where large quantities of species get wiped out. I mean, that in the scientific world, that's the only challenge to Darwin's work. Darwin was of the opinion that things were slow and gradual, and evidence indicates no, they tend to be rather sudden and transitional. But that has nothing to do with whether, you know, there is an intelligent designer out there who is controlling this entire process. Again, why should we be teaching the creation story, essentially, the creation myth of one particular religion, in fact, of one sect within one religion, because there are many of us Christians who are perfectly willing, including the Catholic Church, who are perfectly willing to acknowledge evolution and that the planet is in all probability 6 billion years old. Why should we teach the creation myth of one particular sect of one particular religion in our public state-sponsored schools?
Well, let me correct that statement just a little bit. Intelligent design has nothing to do with religion or the Bible or the gospel. It's completely separate and independent. You can't find a church of intelligent design that you can go to because there isn't any.
Well, the intelligent design, by and large, came out of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. It was formerly called the Center for the Renewal of Science and Culture in Seattle. And in 1999, a document of theirs was leaked. It was called the Wedge Strategy. And they lay it out quite clearly that what they're all about is promoting religion, not science.
Well, actually, the concepts and principles of intelligent design are identical to those of the so-called scientific methods.
No, they're not, because they're not predictive. Intelligent design makes no predictions and can't be scrutinized using the scientific method. I mean, that's the bottom line. A scientific theory has to be predictive. It has to say, if this happens, then this will be the consequence. And intelligent design simply says, things are complicated, we can't figure them out, therefore.
Well, not really. And also, another thought is that intelligent design has been around as long as science has. It just hasn't been called that.
It's well, there's been a whole variety of superstitions that have been around as long as science has. I mean, that you know, if opium addiction has been around as long as science has, that doesn't mean that we should hold it up and put it in our public schools.
Well, as a alternate, because of sweat, some 60% of the people believe in it and don't believe in evolution.
More than 60% of Americans were in favor of slavery at a certain point in the history of this country. That doesn't mean that it's accurate or correct morally.
And that, of course, is completely false. Let's look at it from another direction.
Well, actually, you know, slavery is endorsed by the same book that you're going to for your theory that the universe that is only 6,000 years old. You know, the Bible, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, slavery is endorsed.
No. The universe is infinitely old. It has no beginning and no end. The Earth is only 6,000 years old.
Right. So I stand corrected. Your book that says that your interpretation of your book, which says that. By the way, I don't. You know, having read the Bible several times, I don't see where it says in the Bible that the Earth is 6,000 years old.
Well, the creation week was 1 week of the Lord's time, which is 6,000 of our years.
Well, it doesn't say it was 1 week of the Lord's time in Genesis. It simply says it was 1 week, and Genesis is full of metaphor. I mean, what was the tree of the fruit of knowledge and evil? You'd think that was literal or metaphorical.
Well,
and if it's literal, where's that tree?
Well,
or was that a reference to psychedelics, like Terence McKenna suggests?
Well, the Bible was written by prophets and apostles, and it was not written to confuse us or to mislead us, but to provide us information that's useful to us.
Well, and to try to explain things that in the context of the day were unexplainable. And in the New Testament, where Peter says, you know, a year for the Lord is as 1,000 years, he's not talking about evolution. He's not talking about Genesis. I mean, go back and check the context. He's talking to the other disciples who are being persecuted, and he's basically saying, hang in there. Our day will come.
Yes. Well, I didn't really want to get into a gospel discussion.
But that's the point of it. You want the gospel. You want this religious doctrine to be taught in our public schools, and at the same time, you want to say it's not a religious doctrine. It seems, Dr. Rollins, we're talking with Ronald Rollins. He's the author of God, the Intelligent Designer, KIWEPublishing.com. It seems to me that number one, that contradicts the ideals of the founders of this country, that there should be no religious test. I mean, twice in the Constitution it says no, essentially no religion in government, no religious test for holding public office.
And I agree with that. Yeah,
okay.
I agree with that.
So then why should my tax dollars be used to promote your theological interpretation of science?
No, that's not what I'm saying. I don't want any religious concepts taught in the school. But in the intelligent design has enough information that is independent of religious.
Tell me one thing that the theory of intelligent design predicts.
Well,
That is
as a physical chemist, let me refer to the periodic chart. I'm sure you're familiar with that.
I am. And periodic table, yes.
The periodic table, which sets the elements up in order and shows how they change from one to another.
It doesn't show, the elements don't change from one to another. Well, actually, okay, by atomic process, you're right. The decay, for example, of the superactinides into the actinides into lead, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and you add a neutron and a proton and an electron each time you go up one element. And when the table was first put together and organized, there were holes in it. And information based on similar elements in the same column were used to predict the properties of those elements and to eventually discover them.
But that's the scientific principle. That's not intelligent design. Intelligent design is not predictive.
It's both.
So you're saying that intelligent design says an intelligent designer said, hey, there's holes in the periodic table, and so I'm going to make sure that somebody figures out what should go in there?
I'm saying that whole process could not have come about by chance. It's too...
The process of what? Of figuring out what the holes were in the periodic table?
No. The periodic table itself. could not have been organized by chance. There had to be some intelligent design behind it.
Why?
Because it's too perfect and too orderly. And
don't you think that if you went into a rainforest in Brazil and talked to somebody who'd never had contact with us and showed them a television, that they'd say something equally amazed?
But let me use another example. If you just look at that in nature, at all of the beauty and harmony, and
I'm absolutely in awe of it, Professor Rollins, and it's a major source of inspiration for me as well. I'm sorry we're out of time, but I appreciate your coming on the program. KIWEPublishing.com, the book God, the Intelligent Designer. 16 minutes past the hour.
America Radio with Tom Hartman on the Al Franken Show.
Tree-hugging, love-making, pro-choice and gay-wedding, widespread digging hippies like me. Skin color blinded, conspiracy minded, protesters of corporate greed. We who have nothing and most likely will till we all end up locked up in jail by conservative Christians, right-wing Republicans, straight white American man. Diamonds and dogs, boys and girls, living together in two separate worlds, following leaders of mountains of shame, looking for someone to blame.
And welcome back to the radio support group, up by and for we the people of the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you. Let me put this in context. First of all, we started off the program talking about intelligent design with one of its leading proponents. The ACLU announced last week, just a couple days before Christmas, Georgia School Board drops defense of anti-evolution stickers. The American Civil Liberties Union of Georgia announced today, this was on the 19th of December, announced today that it has received an agreement with the Cobb County School Board. I'm not embarrassed to say, but Louise and I and our three kids lived in Cobb County for 11, 12, 13 years, something like that, in East Cobb and in Marietta and in Roswell. Newt Gingrich was my congressman. What can I say? Anyhow, the ACLU announced today that it has reached an agreement with the Cobb County School Board to keep controversial evolution disclaimer stickers out of biology textbooks, ending a legal challenge that began back in 2002. Stickers read, quote, "This textbook contains material on evolution. Evolution is a theory, not a fact, regarding the origin of living things. This material should be approached with an open mind, studied carefully, and critically considered," end quote. Judge Cooper said, you got to remove these things. And then they asked the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit, to reverse the ruling. But the court held it up, and so for the moment anyway, in Georgia, the stickers are gone. And in a landmark case last year, the ACLU of Pennsylvania, along with Americans United and Pepper Hamilton, successfully argued against promoting the non-scientific ideology of intelligent design in public school science courses. On December 20th, 2005, a federal judge ruled that intelligent design is not science, and that the Dover Area School Board's policy violated the First Amendment guarantee of religious freedom. So, you know, score one for science and rationality, which I find not inconsistent with faith, frankly. I don't see why, in order to be, I mean, every morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, I get up at 3 a.m. to do the morning show and then do show prep for this program and, go outside and it sounds schmaltzy, but, go outside and say my prayers every morning, and I'm looking up at the sky, and I, every single day, am dumbstruck by just how amazing, and the river flowing by, and the tree, and, what I can see, and every night is different, and it takes my breath away some days. And I believe in science. It's not even a belief. I guess any kind of knowledge is a form of belief. But where I want to go with this, and we may have to do it after the break, I'm not sure how much time we have here, but where I want to go with this is Tim Roper and Al Conrad. Thank you, Tim. Tim Roper and Al Conrad at the School of Biological Sciences, University of Sussex, England. When I was writing a book called What Would Jefferson Do? Back, I don't know, 2 years ago or thereabouts. I was one night reading Nature. I subscribe to Nature. I subscribe to New Scientist. I'm a member of the AAAS, so I subscribe to Science as well. And there was this article in Nature, which is, I mean, when you're in Nature, you've made it, right? And there was this article in Nature saying, on January 9th, 2003, by Conrad and Roper, pointing out that the idea of democracy among animals in nature had never been tested. We had always assumed dominance. Darwin was assuming dominance, in fact, that we'd always assumed that nature was organized the way that Victorian England was organized, with kings and kingdoms and lords and ladies and serfs, all the rest. And so they said, well, let's set up a study and find out whether there is any kind of democratic process in nature, or is it all about the alpha deer and the alpha female wolf or the alpha male deer? How does nature work? Is nature organized democratically, or is nature organized in a hierarchical dominating fashion? And the result that they found when they actually did the science on this has turned the science of not just biology and zoology specifically, although it probably can be extended into the plant kingdom as well, on its head. But in my opinion, it is fixing to turn the science of politics, political science, on its head. And this is one of the most important discoveries, in my opinion, in the last 200 years. And I will share the details of this with you, how it worked, right after you come back from the break, and then we'll be taking your phone calls. But this is absolutely remarkable. This research that these guys did that was then replicated by New Scientist magazine in England at the University of Sussex in England and with Red Deer. I'll tell you the quick story of that, and then we'll be taking your calls and continuing with science on this beautiful day. The 28th of December. Tom Hartman with you, 27 minutes past the hour. The place for being progressive never felt so good.
Winding up somewhere, one step ahead or behind. It ain't been so easy, but I guess I shouldn't complain. I've always been crazy, it's kept me from going.
Welcome back. Fair and slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us. 34 minutes past the hour. It's always interesting to debate fundamentalists. I remember a year or so ago, I had one of the guys on from the Westboro Baptist Church, Fred Phelps, and his website is God Hates Fags. And I said, no, you got it wrong. You got it right. Nowhere in the Bible does it say God hates fags. In fact, what it says is that God hates figs. It's a typo. You based your entire church on a typo. This guy had been out protesting just a block down from our house when we lived in Montpelier, Vermont, when we were doing the civil unions thing in Vermont, when the legislature passed that, and they were out there, yelling and screaming and everything. So we got him on the radio, and I said, Matthew 21, Jesus rebukes a fig tree as an evil abomination and withers it. In Mark 11, he commands us not to eat of the cursed fig. On Psalm 78, he destroyed their vines with hail and their sycamore figs with sleet. God's destroying figs. And in Jeremiah 29:17, yes, this is what the Lord Almighty says, I will send the sword, famine, and plague against them, and I will make them like poor figs that are so bad they cannot be eaten. Yes, my friends, God hates figs. He's got no problem with facts. It's figs he hates. And GodHatesFigs.com will tell you all about it. So, sorry for the tangent, the chat room, this whole discussion going out of the chat room, which you can get to over at TomHartman.com, got me going off on that. And talk about small world, by the way. Andrew, who runs our board in New York, also lived in East Cobb County. So, small world. But here's this. I've got to tell you about this study that was done by Conrad and Roper. They said, let's test this thing out. And then after they did their piece, then New Scientist magazine tested it again with the red deer who lived near the university. This was done by James Randerson. And what they found was that the assumption had been red deer, like many mammals, particularly the larger ones, have alpha animals, alpha males. And some species is alpha females, like with wolves, for example. But the assumption was that the deer had to figure out when we're going to go eat. When are we going to head over to the water hole, or one of, there were three water holes nearby. When are we going to go to one of these water holes and drink? Because everybody's sitting around chewing their cud or whatever they do. Deer, I don't think of cuds, but, you know, whatever. We're grazing, and now it's time to go drink. And this is not a small decision, because if you go too soon, some of the members of the community won't get enough nutrients, and over time that could harm them, their health. And if you go too late, some members of the community might get dehydrated. So there has to, I mean, this is literally a life and death decision, particularly then on top of that, you have to decide, okay, which of the three watering holes is the best right now? I mean, the rain, it might have rained recently, which might have made one muddy. It might have made another one even better. There may be a predator near one of them. I mean, there's all these, I mean, if you were to create an equation out of this, it would be multifactorial. All these considerations. How is the decision made? And the assumption was always that the alpha deer would say, okay, guys, time to go. Follow me. And everybody would fall in the line behind the alpha deer, and they'd go to whichever watering hole at whatever time he decided. So they decided to test this. They put cameras up in trees to watch them over a period of several weeks. And what they found was that the animals, now this is the interesting, you know, point that they make in this, is that many authors have assumed despotism in nature without testing for democracy, because the feasibility of democracy, which requires the ability to vote and count votes, is not immediately obvious in non-humans. That's from the science, or from the nature study. Okay. Well, what they found was that the animals, again, quoting now from James Randerson in The New Scientist, he says, in the case of the real red deer, the animals do indeed vote with their feet, by standing up. Likewise with groups of American buffalo. Individuals decide where to go by pointing in their preferred direction. The group takes the average and heads that way. In other words, different animals would be pointing towards different of the water holes while they're chewing. And when 51% of them were pointing toward one of the water holes, then all of you, within a matter of minutes, the entire herd would coalesce into, you know, and move in that direction. And very often the alpha deer would be in the back going, hey, where'd everybody go? Then it gets really interesting. Then they said, okay, now what happens if we put a predator in one of the watering holes, or the appearance of a predator? Now, you know, in our Constitution, for really serious things, it takes 60 votes to break a filibuster in the Senate, not a simple majority of 50 votes. It takes two-thirds vote in the House and Senate to pass a constitutional amendment, and three-quarters of the states, you call supermajorities. For really important things, it takes more than half. Well, when they put a predator by one of the watering holes, the deer would be eating, and you see 49, 50, 51% are now pointing toward watering hole A, and others are pointing toward B and C, but they don't move. And then it goes to 52%, 53%, 54%, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60, 1, 62, 63, 64, 65, 66%, two-thirds. When two-thirds of them are pointing at one of the watering holes, boom, off they go. So I called up Conrad and Roper, and so, you know, I'm writing a book, and I'd like to include a chapter about this in this book that I'm writing, What Would Jefferson Do? And in fact, I think it's also in my new book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. And I said, you know, what happened after you published this article in Nature? Because Nature is like, you know, big deal. Everybody in science reads Nature. And he said, it was incredible. He says, I'm getting calls from entomologists, ichthyologists, ornithologists, I mean, every field of biology or of zoology. And they're all saying essentially the same thing. Now, I'm paraphrasing wildly here from memory. This is 3 years ago. I had a telephone conversation. But you know, I write about it in the book. In essence, he said, you ever seen a swarm of gnats? I remember when I was a little kid, the first time I noticed, I was sitting by a river, and there was this swarm of bugs, little tiny gnats. And it was like a ball of them. And then all of a sudden, the entire swarm moves about 3 feet away. And there's a few left behind going, hey, where'd everybody go? But by and large, you know, they all move at once. And I remember watching birds as they're flying, and the entire flock goes whoop and boom. They've all just turned 5 degrees to the right. Or fish when they're swimming. I remember the first time I went scuba diving and seeing a school of fish, and I came to the conclusion that they were psychic, that there had to be telepathy, that there has to be some form of communication beyond what we had. I mean, that was because they're all moving at the same, what looks to me like to be the same time. Well, it turns out as they're doing slow motion photography, but then they're able to slow down these animals' behavior. They have very, these animals have very rapid peripheral vision, and what they're finding is that they're all voting. That when all of the birds are moving, you know, quarter inch to the left or the right of the fish or the gnats, and when more than 51% of them have moved a quarter inch to the left, the entire herd or flock or swarm moves a quarter inch to the left. Tim Conrad or Tim Roper was telling me he's hearing from even primatologists, even the highest primates. Democracy, it turns out, is the norm in nature, not domination. It is in our DNA. It's wired into our genes. And from the lowliest of insects to us. Isn't that inspiring? Isn't that great news? 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Tony in Freesboro, Tennessee, the home of the Scopes Monkey Trail. Well, not your town, but your state. Hey, Tony.
Hey, how you doing? Great show.
Thank you.
This intelligent design thing is kind of a pet peeve of mine. I'm a... professionally a research scientist, and I am a Christian at the same time, and I don't see any real contradiction between God and evolution myself. To me, you can't answer faith-based questions with science. I mean,
or vice versa.
It's foolish. I mean, yeah, or vice versa. I mean, how are you going to prove that Mozart is a great composer? Or you might as well try to prove my favorite color is blue. You can't do it, and you'd be a fool to try.
Yeah.
And as you said, the flip side, it's, I find it kind of demeaning. I'm sure you're familiar with the God of the Gaps argument. It's basically where if you say, well, God has to fill in these gaps that we can't prove. Well, what that says is as science can prove more and more things and explain more and more things, God gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually is God going to become useless because science can explain most everything?
Yeah, that's a good point.
To me,
ultimately, intelligent design, unless they're successful in rolling back all science, ultimately the theory diminishes religion itself.
Yeah, to me, both. It's to me, for Christians to grab onto this just shows a desperation and a lack of understanding of what faith is all about. And as a scientist, it's kind of just plain silly to try to prove things you can't, that scientists can't predict. So.
Tony, thank you very much for the call. Well said. John in Cobb County, Georgia.
Hey, Mr. Hartman, thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it.
We only have about a minute before we head to...
Okay, no problem. I think it's something off my chest, because even though that this evolution thing is a big deal, there is so much going on in the schools in Cobb County, it's ridiculous. And please let me talk my piece. We have gangs in the school. We have people smoking crack in bathrooms. I saw a motherfucker get sliced for a Newport.
Okay,
the
it's popped a word on the air that we just can't have, so I'm sorry. But John's point was that, you know, really bad stuff is going on in some of the schools in East Cobb County. And why, and I'm assuming that the therefore then was going to be, why are we, you know, arguing about intelligent design? And, first of all, because this is a national thing on my end. I'm bringing it up. And on the other hand, I would say, you know, for the religious folks, for the people who say that they're following the teachings of Jesus, if they want to do something for our public schools, why don't they do it? Go in and do something for our public schools rather than trying to change the curriculum from science to intelligent design. Why don't we try to, you know, like fund them appropriately, have a better classroom, you know, teacher to a student ratio, things like that. 45 minutes past the hour. Back with your calls right after this. And welcome back. It is a beautiful day. 9.5 minutes before the hour here in the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least national health care system and clean elections and a decent candidate. John Edwards announced his candidacy today, by the way. There's a few things I disagree with John about, but I went over and sent $25 to his campaign, just like I did when Dennis Kucinich announced. There's some good people coming down the road here for the Democratic Party. I'm optimistic. Jeff in Manhattan, New York. Hey, Jeff.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Tom, hi, how are you?
Thank you.
Yeah, I've been listening this morning about this back and forth over evolution and intelligent design. So I guess I have to ask you, how would you define evolution?
Evolution is a theory that... Well, wait a second. Why are you asking me, Jeff?
Well, because I used to believe in evolution until I asked myself exactly what I was believing in. And I guess what I, the way I defined evolution was basically it was a series of accidents and mistakes.
No, right? I would not characterize it that
way. I mean, in other words,
There are physical laws that originated with the creation of the universe, and everything that is, in my opinion, everything that's happened since then is consistent with those physical laws and fairly predictable. And look at, they just found living organisms in this incredibly caustic 1,000-degree waste coming out of a chemical plant someplace in California. It's like life is so incredibly tenacious. I believe that life is the norm in the universe, not the exception. And you know,
life is if you took a clock and you took it apart.
Yeah, you're doing Richard Dawkins. Are you talking about Richard Dawkins, the blind clockmaker?
No, I'm just saying if you took a clock and you took it apart into all its smallest pieces and you put it into a bag and you shook up the bag and you dumped the contents of the bag out onto a table, would that clock ever come back out? Would you ever dump it out and the clock would be put back together, working?
No, but the clock is not a living organism. And
that's
if you take a bunch of, is a billion times more complicated than the clock. Yes and no. If you take a bunch of amino acids, free amino acids, and you put them in a solution that resembles the primordial soup, and you shoot lightning through them, you will get the early stages of DNA.
You're forgetting where the amino acids come from.
Well, from the normal chemical processes that combine elements together. Jeff, okay, yeah, ultimately, where does it all come from? I don't know. Jack in San Diego. Hey, Jack.
Yes. Well, look, I've got a theory. How about that the theory of evolution and the theory of intelligent design are compatible? And that if you are the intelligent designer, wouldn't you want your species to have the ability to be able to adapt to their environment and evolve?
Sure, sure. And that's where I think that organized religion, by and large, is probably at. I mean, that's pretty much the Catholic Church's position post Copernicus. Well, actually, post the pardoning of Copernicus by what was it, Pope John Paul II, I think.
And we can discuss intelligent design without interjecting organized religion. I think some of our...
Sort of. The problem is that the folks who are promoting intelligent design, by their own words, are doing so in order to elevate religion and reduce the role of science
in the lives and minds
of the kids in our schools.
Exactly. But I'm not going there. Some of our founding fathers were deists, were they not?
Yes. Arguably, most of the real movers and shakers, Jefferson, Washington, Madison, John Jay, George Mason, yes.
Exactly. Now, I have another theory.
Ben Franklin.
Right. I used to discuss some of these things with my dad, and he'd say, you know, you're never going to figure this out. If you keep thinking about it, it's going to drive you nuts. And I've almost come to the conclusion that since we are in the scale of things like an ant to this universe, we may not have the equipment to be able to understand everything, even though we keep trying to, and that we think that we
right. And so we try to come up with models to explain things. And really, I think the argument here is: shall we deal with a fairly complex model called science, or should we deal with a very simple model that simply says, "Well, somebody else did it. Some omnipotent God or creator, or in some religions, it's the Thetans who came here 10,000 years ago and seeded the planet or whatever."
Yeah, I
think it's the flying spaghetti monster.
You and I are like an antenna in the universe, and there's so much information that we can receive and process, but we're limited by the model of antenna that we are, and we may not have the ability to decipher all of these things that we talk about, including this particular issue.
Sure. I agree with you, Jack. And I think another metaphor that you could use is the TV metaphor. If you've got a TV and you've got it tuned to channel 2, does that mean that channel 4 no longer exists? Sure looks like it. Doesn't seem to exist. And you tune it to channel 4, what happened to channel 2? Now it doesn't exist. And what about those frequencies that the TV can't receive at all? Are they there? Yes, they are. So, anyhow, Dan in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Dan, we've got about a minute before we have to wrap up this hour, although we can continue the conversation the next hour. What's up?
I think that the fundamentalists who propose the intelligent design notion are blasphemous because, first of all, I think most of them are perfectly aware of the logical fallacy of what they're saying, and so they're unethical. But they're blasphemous in the sense that they don't give God credit for being transcendent. And they want to have an image of an intelligent designer using human intelligence as their model. And if they really give God the reverence that their scripture says he is due, then they need to realize that that is a concept of something they're not supposed to understand.
Yeah, in other words, what they're doing is the ultimate anthropomorphism.
It's idolatry.
They're creating God in man's image.
Yes, it's idolatry.
Yeah.
It is.
Well said. Dan, thank you very much. That's a great note to end the hour on. We'll come back with more of your phone calls and also some news of the day. There are things happening out there in the world, including John Edwards announcing Jerry Ford, his notes now being published by Bob Woodward in the Washington Post, what he had to say about George W. Bush, about his old employees, Don Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. Not too happy about them. We'll get into that. We can continue this conversation in the third hour of our program. Lamar Waldron's going to be on with me. Lamar and I wrote this book called Ultimate Sacrifice about the coup in Cuba. And what's going on with Castro right now? 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Well, this is interesting. This is from Milton Keynes. Welcome back, by the way. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Milton Keynes in the United Kingdom. Milton Keynes, the home of Sue, who runs our chat room, Sue Netiquette. If you drop into our live chat room at tomhartman.com and say hi, and also helps run our message boards. Books and DVDs questioning Darwinism and claiming a higher being created the earth have been sent to schools in Milton Keynes. This is kind of an outlying suburb of London. The literature produced in America was sent, actually it's a stone town, produced in America was sent out, in fact I've been there, I gave a speech there on attention deficit disorder about a decade ago. The literature produced in America was sent out by a national group called Truth in Science, which aims to replace materialistic explanations with the theory that mankind was created by God, etc. The school board said, no thanks. Yeah, good on that. In other news, just broadly speaking here, the dollar dropped the most in a week against the euro, and there were dollar saggings all over the place, at least for a few hours. It bounced back a little bit as the initial housing numbers came in. It looks like the housing collapse is not happening, that the U.S. housing markets may be recovering slightly. But what happened is the United Arab Emirates said, we don't want those stinking dollars. The UAE's, this is from Bloomberg, the UAE's decision to relocate its reserves is part of a theme that means the U.S. dollar holdings and global currency reserves are decreasing. The dollar is going to lose support as we see Fed rate cuts next year. That's assuming that there will be. And as of October now of last year, this is just, they're just talking about this now because you have to go back and crunch numbers like crazy. But it looks like as of October last year, there were more countries using the euro. This is from the Financial Times. More countries using, that there were more euros in circulation around the world than dollars. The first time the dollar has been surpassed by another currency, that currency being the euro. And it's only a five-year-old currency. The value of euro notes in circulation is this month likely to exceed the value of circulating dollar notes, according to calculations by the Financial Times. Converted at Wednesday's exchange rates, the euro took the lead in October. The figures highlight the remarkable growth in the euro. What does this mean? The bottom line is what it's going to mean for Americans, for us, is that we are getting poorer as the world is getting richer. Why? Because of 26 years of conservative, radical conservative voodoo economics. From domestic policies that slash taxes at the highest brackets and migrate wealth from the middle class to the very wealthy and generate huge deficits. Pardon the sneeze there. and generate, you know, these $8 trillion deficit from those policies to our insane trade policies. Let me just, by the way, one more time give you the definition of a theory. A theory is not a hunch, it's not an opinion. One of the most robust theories in modern science is the theory of evolution. A theory has to have an explanation that can be tested, it has to be grounded in evidence, and it has to be able to predict natural phenomena in the future and have those predictions validated better than competing theories. So, it's not just, maybe that would be a good idea. And John Edwards today came out and said that he was running for president of the United States. And not only did he say that he's running for president of the United States, but there were a few, you know, let's take a pot shot at George W. Bush comments in here. This is actually from his announcement. I believe this is from yesterday because he's referring to making an announcement today. I'm not sure exactly when this was recorded, in the last 24 hours. And here is John Edwards announcing his 2008 presidential bid and what he wants to do about it.
I'm John Edwards, and I'm in the Upper Ninth Ward of New Orleans, where we've been working this afternoon, me along with these kids who are working behind me, try to restore a home that was devastated by the hurricane. And tomorrow morning from this place, I'll announce that I'm a candidate for President of the United States. What I will do is ask millions of Americans, including you, to join me in taking action and taking responsibility.
Now, just notice that I'm going to ask millions of Americans to join. This isn't just a candidate saying, "Hey, come here and hang out with me." And by the way, I'm not endorsing anyone at this point for president of the United States. I think that we've got a bunch of great candidates. I really like Dennis Kucinich as well. There's some very, very good people. I think Al Gore would actually make a good candidate, even though he was in favor of global free trade and may still be. I'm not sure. But the point that I wanted to make about what John Edwards just said and what he's about to say as we continue this clip is, we're back to the red deer that we were talking about in the last hour. The idea that when a critical mass is reached among the people, among we the people, among the members of the species, when a critical mass is achieved, the leaders have no say in it any longer. It must be, unless they're absolute despots. And the history of despotism is that it may last for a while. It may even last for a few generations, but ultimately despotism fails. Despots make the worst decisions, not the best decisions, even if they're the most experienced. In fact, I put the book away now, but when I was reading from What Would Jefferson Do, sharing with you that, you know, the part about the red deer, they make the point that even in those animal species where the alpha animal is also generally, typically, the most experienced of the animals, and they're therefore theoretically the most knowledgeable, that animal's decision don't stand. It's the group's decision. Because the group is less likely, over time, to make dangerous mistakes. And over time, the wisdom of the group will exceed that of the individual. Thomas Jefferson believed in this. This is what got me started, and this is why it's in the book, What Would Jefferson Do? The Declaration of Independence. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume upon the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them. A decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, etc. That's how the Declaration of Independence starts. The laws of nature and nature's God. And Thomas Jefferson wrote that, and John Adams came in the next day, along with Ben Franklin and George Mason, to edit it. And the notes are there. You can see the edited copies. They still exist. And John Adams said, we need to take out this nature's God stuff and put in the Christian God. And Jefferson, who was a deist, said, no, I see God in all of nature. I don't need to walk into a box, into a church to see God. God's everywhere. In fact, Jefferson rewrote the Christian Bible. He took the first four Gospels, the four Gospels, the first four books of the New Testament, and cut out all of, with a razor blade, I mean, he literally cut and pasted the thing, cut out all the miracles. And it has been now a demiracalized New Testament, or first four books of it, has been in print since he did it. Well, since he left the presidency. Until this day. It's still in print. It's called the Jefferson Bible. So anyhow, he believed that that democracy was part of a divine order, but also part of nature, that it was all one and the same, that it was all the same thing. And here's John Edwards, in my opinion, and frankly, I think all candidates ultimately realize that this is what they have to rely on, of getting the parade together, getting the herd together.
Not sitting around waiting for somebody else to do it, but actually going out and doing it ourselves from the ground up and taking action now, not in the future. We're not waiting for election day. And we need change badly, from establishing our moral leadership in the world, starting with Iraq. We need to reject this McCain doctrine of surging troops and...
This is where John Edwards is, you know, just kicking these guys' butts.
Escalating the war in Iraq. We need to make it clear we're going to leave, and we need to start leaving Iraq. We need to get engaged in the genocide in Sudan, in the atrocities in northern Uganda, which I've seen firsthand, doing something about the issue of global poverty. Leading on global warming, something that could affect all of our lives, starting today. Starting today, this is something that can't be done without all of us taking action, leading to a new energy economy in this country, doing something about the issue of poverty, which I've been working on, doing something about the issue of health care, where we desperately need universal health care in America. We can do these things because I've seen it done. Just in the last couple of years, we've raised the minimum wage in six states. We've actually organized thousands of workers across this country.
You get it? He's talking about the herd here. He's talking about the parade.
We made college available to kids who were willing to work. I saw kids working on the ground in Uganda. We can bring about the change that we believe in. We can create the change that America needs. But we need you to do that. We need you to join us in this cause.
Yeah, and that's the bottom line, is we all have to become activists. It can't just be a few radio activists out there, like, you know, me and all the folks at Air America. We all need to be active in the herd, right? We need to be part of it. 866-440-THOM, our telephone number. TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. However you spell it, we'll get you there. We are live. It's Thursday the 28th of December, and we will be back right after the 16 minutes past the hour. The place where being progressive never felt so good.
I cleared the rocks and timber from the wild New England shore. I labored long and hard to make it grow. I built the first log cabins and I raised a family, told King George and all his redcoats where to go. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track, I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars, and I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
And welcome back to the program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Tom Hartmann here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. Also, our program filling in for Al Franken's show all this week. Both our programs run at the same time, so we're running this show all across Air America throughout last week and this. While Al is in Iraq, God bless him, doing a USO tour. And I mean, just the idea of going to Iraq, and I've been in some pretty grim places. I mean, I did international relief work for 26 years on and off. But to be in the middle of a war zone that's filled with depleted uranium and people who want to kill you, and I take my hat off to them. Yesterday we told the story of a fellow who had been called back for another deployment to Iraq and said he wasn't going to go. They were going to tear gas his house to get him out of the house, and so he committed death by cop, suicide by cop. He came out and pointed a gun at them, and so they blew him away. Today, in today's paper, this is from the Chicago Sun-Times, Steve Henderson served his country during two tours of duty as an Army sergeant in Afghanistan, repeatedly coming under enemy fire and seeing fellow soldiers maimed and U.S. helicopters gunned down. The Chicago native is back home after being honorably discharged 20 months ago. He's married, working toward a college degree, but the Army has called upon him again. A letter he received 2 weeks before Christmas orders him to report to Fort Benning, Georgia by January 14th. Under the order, he is required to fight in Iraq for a period, quote, not to exceed 545 days, end quote. But this time, Henderson says he will not serve his country. He says, I have no intention of going to Iraq. Well, I wish you well, Stephen, in your challenge of that. He's going to try and challenge it by legal means and appeal, and good on you. 1-866-440-8466. Art in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Art.
Hey, Tom. How you doing, buddy?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's up?
I was listening to your junior college professor talking about the theory of whatever it is that he's pitching. And I
of intelligent design, yeah.
I was reminded of a guy who's now dead, Charles Johnson, who was the head of the International Flat Earth Society.
That was tongue in cheek, was it not?
You remember this?
Yeah, well, this was like 25 years ago you're talking about.
About that, and this guy was down in Central California, and he was pitching the fact that the Bible says that there are four corners of the earth.
Right.
And he succeeded that by saying that actually the earth is a flat plate like a frisbee,
right,
and that it is not round.
Right.
And
he had a whole elaborate theory to explain it. I remember that. I was a teenager that when that was going on.
Yeah.
But it was. I always thought he was doing that tongue-in-cheek to prove.
No, he wasn't.
He was
serious about this. I used to hear him on talk shows, and he was deadly serious. And he thought that the whole thing about landing on the moon was a fake, and that they'd done it in Hollywood.
Yeah.
And then I heard you say something that inspired me, because you talked about God hates figs.
Yeah, if you go to godhatesfigs.com, you'll find the actual quotes.
And that's provable, because the most outstanding fig of our time is Isaac Newton. Fig Newton. And as a result, wait, now, you're laughing. I'm thinking about, it's now the theory of gravity.
Right.
And it's not the law, it's the theory of gravity. And
right,
theoretically, we could just rise out of our chairs and float to the junior college professor, whatever, I don't know.
Yeah.
Other than that, you're doing a great show.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Art. Great to hear from you. Thanks for listening to us there on Talk 1090 in Seattle.
Why not?
Indeed. Paul in Turner's Falls, Massachusetts. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Tom. This is a great topic. It's a huge discussion. The thing that I was thinking about when the man previously was talking about the clock pieces.
Yeah.
Very often the way we explain things gets stuck in a particular scientific model, and that's sort of a Newtonian way of looking at the world. Everything is it's a big cosmic machine.
Yeah, it's actually Aristotle was the guy who first, you know, put forward the idea of the world as a machine rather than a living organism. But I your point well taken.
And the thing that I'm interested in now, of course, chaos theory is another way of describing the world, and I really appreciate the notion of emergent properties, how things rising from simpler systems can become more complex in a particular way, like a cloud of gas collapsing and becoming a star.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, everything around that star is changed because of an emergent property. Mm-hmm. And one of the ones that really strikes me is consciousness, because who can remember when they first became aware of being alive?
Mm-hmm.
And all of the creations of consciousness, including theories of evolution, intelligent design, the Bible, are all, in a sense, emergent properties. And the risk is that we get stuck. If we get stuck with a particular model of the universe, and it doesn't change as the universe changes, we can end up making big mistakes.
Yeah, and thus, you know, science is kind of, we had string theory, you know, going on 15, 20 years ago, and now it's, the universe is foam and bubbles and froth and, you know, black holes and everything else.
Quite
remarkable.
If I have one quick additional thing, Tom, there's an alternative to intelligent design. A guy named Michael Dowd talks about the great story. He puts the mythology back.
Hang on, Paul. 27 minutes past the hour.
Forces of the world unite. Let us save the day. Malcontents without 5 cents want us to cut our pay. We only make 500 times as much as our average worker drones. We work just as hard, and we too sometimes need to paint our homes. The pressures are incredible, and no one seems to care. We moved our plants to Haiti, and now we have to move from there. They're clamoring for more than a dollar a day, from Malaysia to Mexico.
At that rate, pretty soon there'll be no place for us to go.
Yes, bosses of the world unite.
Bosses of the world unite. Don't just sit there, fight, fight, fight.
Indeed. How dare those workers demand more than a dollar a day? 35 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio. Yes, this program, all programs ultimately on commercial radio, supported by you, the listeners, by listening for and supporting your local sponsors, the sponsors you hear on your local affiliate stations, and also our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, saving the planet one cup at a time, 1-800-425-2532. SacredGroundsCoffee.com. Small Dog Electronics, getting the latest iPods and all things Macintosh, 1-800-511-MAX, M-A-C-S, or SmallDog.com. And the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, or EcoWine.com. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And Bill in Madison, Wisconsin, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, John?
Tom.
Oh. Sorry about that. Yeah,
Bill, I be Tom.
hey, you're on the air. Tom. Hey,
What's
I just
up?
Wanted to talk about this whole creationism idea. I got an aunt who is very fervent about this whole whole concept, and I had a long discussion with her, and I like how you put everything in a historical context, because being 21 years old, historical context is pretty much the only way that I have to look at things, so... I want to suggest a book to you if you haven't read it. It's called The Shadows of Forgotten Ancestors. And it takes a good look at from a completely objective perspective of the history of the world through just collective scientific method. And it is well referenced. It's a sizable read, and it keeps it interesting, so it allows you to absorb a pretty fine.
And the conclusion of the book, Bill, is what?
Say again?
What's the conclusion of the book?
Actually, I haven't gotten to it yet.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, is it a pro-science or pro-intelligent design?
Well, it is a pro-science look at things. Intelligent design, I have to agree with that. That previous caller is a blasphemous outlook on life.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, it sounds fascinating. One of the things that I find really interesting, there's a number of really good ethnographies of Aboriginal and Indigenous people. Charles Darwin actually tried to compile some.
Charles Darwin, his words are featured in this book quite a bit.
His book, Descent of Man.
He quote out of this that wraps this up really well.
If it's less than a sentence, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, if it's less than a sentence?
Yeah.
Okay.
People reading on the air just doesn't make for good radio, Bill. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you're welcome
true.
To tell me what it says. But I think you have, and your point is well taken, and I appreciate
it. Essentially, I can sum it up in a sentence. So.
Sure.
It's essentially when we no longer look at organic beings as just like ships, then as something that's beyond our comprehension, then we contemplate it as a complex structure, useful as the summing up of many contrivances. So basically, it talks about if we look at the human body as something that's not just a collection of everything. It is something that is transcended through a collection of separate experience.
Right. Yeah.
So that idea is.
Yeah. Well said, Bill. Well said. And then thank you very much for the call and for the. You know, this is where one of the big areas. I there's an entire chapter I devote to in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, which is about how our. It's about peak oil, but it's also about how our culture is self-destructing, in large part because of the destructive cultural myths we have. And I think one of the most destructive myths that we have that we need to wake up from, frankly. And that we don't share with Indigenous and Aboriginal people, that we can learn from them and recalibrate our myths in a way that are positive and useful, is the idea that everything around us, including us, is just a machine. I mean, the reality is, if I take my car apart, assuming that I have rudimentary knowledge of auto mechanics, if I take my car apart all over the driveway and then put it back together and I know what I'm doing, I can turn it on and it'll run. But if I take a cow apart all over my driveway, and then put it back together, even if I have very advanced knowledge of biology, he's not going to run. There's a fundamental difference between living systems and machines.
And Aristotle, you know, the atomic theory, fundamental atomic theory, and this early Greek notion of the universe as a machine. You know, it was really useful in that it led to science and the scientific model. But frankly, I have to say, I think it's also very limited and limiting, and in many ways, it's one of the things that's destroying the planet. We just think, if we can just figure out where the levers are, if we can just pull the right lever, we can solve all the problems. And it's not about levers. It's about interpenetrated, organic, living, biological, and frankly, I think beyond biological, I hesitate to use the word spiritual. Aboriginal people certainly do. In fact, the book that I'm going to do for Buzzflash next month, I'll be writing the review this weekend, Terence McKenna's Who to the Gods. I think that consciousness is part of the whole thing. I think consciousness is part of life as an independent force. But I'm starting to get too esoteric, so we'll go back to George in Denver. Hey, George, what's up?
Not much. I heard somebody argue, maybe it was your guest, that it's the beauty and order of the world that requires an intelligent designer.
Yeah.
Bringing up the periodic table.
Yeah.
Now, certainly the intelligent designer has beauty and order. So applying their same argument, that intelligent designer needs a designer.
And, yeah, exactly. Who created God?
And then on and on, we'd have and if we did have an intelligent designer, what's up with flesh eating bacteria or
the Holocaust,
smallpox virus and stuff like that?
Or things that are independent of human behavior. Yeah. Good point, George. And those are the questions that never get explained. And in fact, if you follow the logic, you know, that God created us and then kind of tortures us until we decide to go along with a particular set of rules, it's sort of like the sociopathic kid who, you know, collects bugs in a jar just so that he can torture them with a pencil. You know, or George W. Bush putting firecrackers and frogs and blowing them up and thinking that's really very, very funny as a child. I don't, you know, my God is not a sadist. I'm sorry.
One thing about the word theory, go to a library, go to the math section, and you'll find books on number theory,
sure,
theory of functions, which is complex variables, and these aren't, it just simply means, in that case, an area of knowledge.
Yes, yeah, it means something that can be demonstrated to a large extent by physical phenomena, or in the case of math, you know.
Proof.
Yeah, yeah, the proofs, and math proofs are a little different than hey, that's a truck coming down the road at me proofs. But it's, yeah, good point. George, thank you very much for the call. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi, Dan.
WTKG. Julian.
We talked briefly before about this. Even though I'm progressive, I happen to be one of those people who thinks that intelligent design at least possibly could be a good scientific theory.
Why do we need an intelligent designer, Julian? Why can't we say the intelligent designer, the consciousness that brought everything into being? I mean, I'm of the opinion that if I have consciousness, that whatever is greater than me must, you know, my consciousness must be just a very, you know, it's like the moon reflected in a pool. It must be a very small thing compared to that. But why can't consciousness that is the universe slow parts of itself down and become energy, which slows down and becomes matter, and through gravity becomes the universe, and through a series of purely physical laws ultimately organizes itself as the world that you and I are sitting in?
I have no problem with that view.
Well, I think that's, you know, by and large, that's the scientific view of the creation of the world.
Well, no.
You know, if you take out the consciousness started it part, okay, that's my insertion. but you know, and see, the science doesn't say that consciousness didn't start it all. What science says is we don't know, and so we're not going to go there. Science is silent on that topic.
Okay. The point is that there is phenomena which can best be explained by having an intelligent cause.
But just because you and I can best explain it that way doesn't mean it's real. I mean, lightning was best explained for a long, long time by Odin throwing thunderbolts at us.
True. And so we found out differently. Now, that is the point. Intelligent design theory is capable of being falsified. It can be falsified by finding a better theory. Now, Darwin's theory, the idea that it came about through random mutation, there have been serious challenges to it, not just from intelligent design theorists, but also from just regular biologists.
No, what Darwin suggested is random mutations occur, and those mutations which enhance survivability will persist, and those that don't enhance survivability will die off. And that's been demonstrated.
Well,
I mean, that's demonstrated, you know, on an ongoing basis all over the world.
That's been demonstrated as far as microevolution is concerned.
Well, I mean, as far as macroevolution, I mean, we're seeing this with species right now.
No, it isn't. No, it hasn't demonstrated macro.
Well, Darwin... Well, okay. All right. Well, Julian, I think we've reached a point where the dog is chasing his tail here in our discussion. But good talking with you. Thank you for calling in. And we've got to take a break here. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. TomHartman.com, 866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman is your gift from the Al Franken Show and Air America.
It's good to be king, just for a while. To be there in velvet, yeah, to give them a smile.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
It's good to be king of your own town.
And welcome back. Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Just a heads up, January 5th, a week from tomorrow, I will be in Pittsburgh doing this program live from our affiliate WPTT, 1360 AM. And I will do a book signing that night at the Borders in Monroeville, Pennsylvania, 7 PM. And on the following day, on Saturday the 6th, I'll be in Minneapolis, Minnesota. At 2 p.m., I'll be doing a book signing that is put on by Magers and Quinn. It's not actually at the bookstore. I don't have the location in front of me. I'm sorry. But you can call Magers and Quinn in Minneapolis and get that information. And then January 12th through the 14th, 3 weeks from now, I'll be in Reno, Nevada, where Crude Impact, a movie that I'm in, and my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, will be playing at the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival. And then at the end of January, we'll be in Washington, D.C. for Radio Row, the week of the State of the Union. So should be interesting stuff. And this is all around my newest book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class, that Amazon has right now for an additional 5% off. Shameless plug department. Paul in Turner Falls, Massachusetts. Paul, I put you on hold 15, 20 minutes ago and said I'll be right back. You had a sentence you wanted to wrap up with. I'm sorry, I missed the button.
That's okay, Tom. Thanks for bringing me back. What I wanted to finish up with is I was talking about emergent properties, and since both religion and science are emergent properties, the difficulty is that many religions get stuck mm-hmm. on a particular model where science moves on. And I wanted to tell you about a website. It's thegreatstory.org. A couple, Connie Barlow and Michael Dowd, travel the country in a van. They live out of their van, bringing the story of the sacredness of current models of science. And it's beautiful because, in a way, their work brings the mythology and the sacredness up to date with where science is, so that children can be excited about being made of stardust.
Exactly. Yeah, and that's one of the things I think this is... Actually, I've got that story in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. I don't think most people realize, in order for the heavy materials, the heavy atoms to have occurred, you know, the stuff that our body is made of, or most of the stuff that our body is made of, other than the lighter gases, this stuff has to be in a nuclear reaction in the heart of a star, and that star... And the heavy elements then is hydrogen forms helium, and then helium combine, you know, and through the nuclear fusion reactions becomes progressively heavier and heavier elements, and those sink deeper and deeper into the star until finally the star has to die and explode out in a nova or supernova. And the explosion of that star is where the elements that make the hard physical worlds, the planets, come from. And we literally are made of stardust. Literally.
A quick story. They tell a story of a mother who was telling about a piece of family history, and her daughter said, "Well, was I alive when this happened?" And mom said, "No." And, "Well, was I in your tummy?" And mom said, "No." And she said, "Well, I must have been stardust."
Exactly.
Yeah.
We are all stardust, to badly paraphrase Joni Mitchell, I think it was. Thank you, Paul. That was very, very well said. Gary in Setauket, New York. Hey, Gary.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I heard the theory of evolution explained to me one time, and basically it was this, that the changes that nature keeps, you know, or any change doesn't occur in a vacuum. So, you know, if a change works, it's kept and then built upon, and that change might change until it finds another change that works. So it's not like, you know, you take that clock and you throw all the pieces on, you know, you take it apart, you throw it into a bag, and you throw it out. If a clock doesn't come out, you know, after you throw it on the table, well, then evolution doesn't work. It would be kind of like taking the bag, shaking it up with the parts, throwing it out. Wow, two of these gears happen to be together. Now you keep that. You put that off to the side. You shake the bag up again. And then once you have a bunch of these pieces that do fit, then you take all those pieces, put it in the bag, and shake it up. Now you're working on a larger organism. And, you know, that would be the way I would explain it to that guy who was talking about the clock, even though it's...
That's brilliant, Gary.
Excuse me?
That's brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
And you're spot on right. But that's brilliant. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. David in Bremerton, Washington. Hey, David.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I was intrigued by your comments on regarding the evidence that supported democracy in natural communities. You mentioned the red deer.
Yes.
One of the myths that's been propagated by conservatives over the years has been this idea that democracy is somehow this very special, delicate institution, like a tightrope where we can easily be blown off.
Right. This is the idea that John Adams and Alexander Hamilton had. Yeah.
It's kind of like Thomas Hobbes,
you know.
Right, it was invented like only 2,500 years ago by the Athenian Greeks, and then after the Peloponnesian Wars, it went into decline and wasn't revived.
No, actually, democracy has existed all that time among Aboriginal and Indigenous people. It is the standard form of human organization and has been for probably the 160,000-year history of the human race.
Right, and then consider that, you know, in these institutions, in these ancient societies, and I learned this from anthropology, it was quite a shock to me to learn that, you know, democracy was not this thing that was invented by Americans just 200-some-odd years ago, but actually, in their societies, they had elections, they had voting, they had elected leaders, they shared their wealth, you know, they had a division of labor based upon merit and... abilities and all these things that we favor.
No, you're absolutely right, David. And we're out of time for this hour, but I appreciate the call. It's like Ben Franklin. You know, there's 34 or 37 members of the Iroquois Confederacy at the Constitutional Convention, and Ben Franklin stood up to introduce them. His speech is still on the record. He said something to the effect of, this is from memory, if six nations of, you're talking to the Iroquois Confederacy, if six nations of ignorant savages can forge a union that has survived in peace for 1,000 years, certainly 13 colonies of educated Englishmen can do the same. And he wasn't speaking ill of them, by the way. It was just how they spoke back in those days. But yeah, democracy is the most ancient form of governance among humans because it's natural. 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. And radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you. 18 years ago, more or less, Lamar Waldron and I, this is back when I was living in Cobb County, referencing an earlier hour, living in Georgia, where Lamar lives now, down in Atlanta way. Lamar Waldron and I decided to look into what happened back in 1963 with the assassination of John Kennedy, and that, what has now been 18 years of research, 17 and change, has led to a book called Ultimate Sacrifice. In the process of tracking that down, Lamar tracked down some information about a guy named Harry Enrique Williams. I tracked down Harry Enrique Ruiz Williams, and And we learned from him about an operation that the Kennedys were planning on running against Castro in December of 1963, which we ultimately discovered led ultimately directly to the death of Jack Kennedy. Long story short. And the book is out now. It's called Ultimate Sacrifice by Lamar with me. Lamar did most of the writing on the this final edition of it. And he and I did a lot of the research back the first 10 years, anyway, that we were working on it. And Lamar is with us here. Hey, Lamar.
Hey, Tom. Good to be here. And we should let people know in advance that things they're going to hear today that are impacting Cuba big time right now it can only be found in the trade paperback of Ultimate Sacrifice that right. just came out a couple months ago, because a lot of the things we'll be talking about today were so secret we could not even include them in last year's hardback edition.
Because we did not want to go to jail.
Well, we didn't want to go to jail. We didn't want to
harm the national security.
But the government, they made the decision in writing twice to release this information so we could put it in the trade paperback. It's out now, and yet it's having a big impact between the U.S. and Cuba right now, but no one knows about it because it has been kept secret for so long. In fact, people are going to hear some very familiar names of people who are current in politics today and recently who helped keep this information secret, and yet at the same time they're still not willing to face the reality that this information is out there.
Those people being Cheney, Rumsfeld, for example.
Negroponte, new Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, George Bush Sr., Alexander Haig, Edward Meese back on the Iraq Study Group. Just an awful lot of people, and again, you know, Cheney and Rumsfeld kind of head the list, and
right.
It's just amazing how much we keep repeating history with a lot of the same people decade after decade after decade, but now we've got some pretty unique opportunities now that this information is out, you know, thanks in part to you and I, but again, so many people are just acting as if this information has not been released.
Right. Liz Smith in the New York Post Liz Smith did a great kind of summary of what we've come up with here, but it hasn't really been broadly picked up, and I think it's one of the it's really amazing. Raul Cat, the United States of America, not you and I collectively, but we, the United States of America, and by the way, to our callers and listeners, we'll be getting back to your calls right after the next break. But we have been approached now, essentially, by Raul Castro and Juan Almeida for, in my opinion, rapprochement, for an attempt to work things out with the U.S. government, and the Bush administration is completely ignoring it, and as far as I know, we're the only people who are running around saying, hey, look at what's going on here. So let me just toss it to you, Lamar. What's going on here?
And we can also, like you said, give Liz Smith some credit. Of all the journalists in America, she's been the one who's been willing to report, you know, these facts.
Several times, in fact.
But you're right. In other words, Raul Castro has been issuing olive branches to the U.S. Since August, you know, since Fidel had to temporarily, some say, step aside. And even more fascinating, since this new information has come out, two big olive branches, one in public, maybe even a third, and yet, even Democrats in Congress and moderate Republicans aren't aware of what's happening. So the reason these olive branches are not being picked up or not being acted upon by the Bush administration is because they don't want to expose decades of their own cover-ups and intelligence failures that relate
to... That go all the way back to the Kennedy assassination and the events, events against Cuba that go back before that.
Exactly. They frankly go back to the Bay of Pigs, which I know, you know, for a lot of some of your movie-going audience figures into the new picture, The Good Shepherd, and it talks
yes.
about the Bay of Pigs. And
Operation Zapata.
Right. And the Good Shepherd's a very good movie, well-acted, well-directed, well-written. Unfortunately, what they say about the Bay of Pigs is fictional. But it just goes to show how even things like the Bay of Pigs have never been truly exposed and resolved. And here's what people can find only in the new trade paperback of our book for the first time. Going back to
our book, Ultimate Sacrifice.
Ultimate Sacrifice, the new trade paperback edition, is right before the Bay of Pigs, 1961, okay? this big invasion that JFK inherited from Eisenhower and Nixon after JFK won by that narrow margin.
Yeah, this was going to be Nixon's October surprise in the 1960 election.
Well, it actually, the invasion was, and it was actually going to be the mafia murder of Fidel Castro, and that
right.
didn't quite work out. So then they took some of the plan and increased the Cuban exile invasion. But what happened was, it's only in our book, but this is backed up by declassified CIA files. It's just a month or so before the Bay of Pigs invasion. The head of the Cuban army, a famous commander, hero of the revolution, actually bigger in many ways than Che Guevara, named Commander Juan Almeida, the commander of the Cuban army, was telling Western diplomats in Havana, hey, I want to defect. I want to come over. I want to help the Americans.
Right.
Now that would be a great thing to have, right? The head of the Cuban army, and especially if you're the CIA, you know you're getting ready for this exile invasion of Cuba. Except the CIA didn't feel they needed Commander.
Right, because they already had the mafia. They already had Traficante and Roselli and
they had, you're right. They had these mafia godfathers. They thought, we don't need the head of the Cuban army. We're going to have the mafia assassinate Fidel, and that's what's really going to bring down Cuba,
right.
Not these exiles. Well, here's the biggest tragedy of all. Is Fidel had no idea exactly where this invasion was going to happen. It was pretty much an open secret it was going to happen. So Fidel thirded Cuba up. He took the middle third with Havana. He gave the eastern third to Raul Castro, his brother. And he gave the western part of Cuba to his most trusted commander, the commander of the army, Commander Juan Almeida. Well, that part of Cuba included the Bay of Pigs. So the CIA missed this golden opportunity to have the man in charge of defending the Bay of Pigs to actually work for them because they had put their trust in the mafia instead. Now, flash ahead a couple of years. Commander Almeida never gave up his dream of trying to help the U.S. get rid of Fidel and bring a more moderate government into Cuba.
Right. So Harry told us that Almeida approached Harry and said, let's work out something. And this became Bobby Kennedy's program.
A huge plan, very well documented. The CIA code name was AM World. The CIA only had a supporting role. The Kennedys were not about to trust the CIA again in this. So in November of 1963, Commander Almeida, head of the Cuban army, was secretly working with John and Robert Kennedy to stage a coup against Castro. It was set for December 1st, 63, just 10 days after JFK would get back from Dallas. However, the CIA was still working with the mafia on their own plots to try to kill Fidel through their CIA connections. These mafia godfathers, some of the same ones involved in the Bay of Pigs, Sandro Traficante of Tampa, Roselli of the Chicago Mafia, Carlos Marcello, who controlled Louisiana and East Texas, infiltrated.
And who controlled Jack Ruby,
exactly,
we should add.
Exactly right.
Anyway.
And so these three mafia bosses infiltrated the JFK Almeida coup plan, used parts of it to murder JFK in a way that forced the government, including Bobby Kennedy, to cover up key information in order.
Including Jerry Ford.
Jerry Ford was part of the Warren Commission.
Right, which was part of the cover-up. And this was done for the very best of reasons, which was to prevent World War III from
happening. Exactly, because this was just a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis. Also to protect, your listeners should know, Commander Almeida, head of the Cuban Army, not suspected. Fidel didn't suspect him.
So we have less than a minute, Lamar. Here's Almeida. He was working with Harry. He was working with Bobby back then. He disappeared for a few years. You and I weren't even sure if he was still alive. Suddenly he reappears about a year ago, and he's back in charge of the army. And now Raul is pushing him out front constantly. And we're of the opinion that this is an attempt by Cuba to say to the U.S. government, hey, you guys want to talk?
That's exactly right. In other words, our book, the word of our book came out in September. In October, a high Cuban official actually issued a statement, not to the Cuban people, but to a British website, denouncing our book as a CIA trick. But again, we know the Cuban officials knew about it. In November of this year, Fidel issues another olive branch secretly through the Swiss embassy. In early December, December 2nd, Raul has Almeida beside him on the podium while he issues yet another olive branch.
Right, this former CIA guy. And you can find it all over at ultimatesacrificethebook.com. Lamar Waldron, Tom Hartman, the author and co-author, Ultimate Sacrifice. Lamar, thanks for being with us today.
Hey, thank you very much, Tom.
And hopefully the Bush administration will start listening to what's coming out of Cuba. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back.
1861, when Ike went out, the people in the South began to shout. In the last 8 years, everybody starved to death. The people up in Lucknow ain't even got breath. Please, Mr. Kennedy, won't you help us out? Well, I ain't had a square meal in a long, long time. The farmers in Missouri, they ain't made a dime. The miner in West Virginia, he's really in a jam. And the hogs in Virginia, too poor to grow hams. Please, Mr. Kennedy, won't you help us out?
And welcome back. 22 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman program here. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no. A chance. Speaking of Mr. Kennedy, just a thought for the day.
What do our opponents mean when they apply to us the label liberal? If by liberal they mean, as they want people to believe, someone who is soft in his policies abroad, who is against local government, and who is unconcerned with the taxpayer's dollar, then the record of this party and its members demonstrate that we are not that kind of liberal. But if by a liberal they mean someone who looks ahead and not behind, someone who welcomes new ideas without rigid reactions, someone who cares about the welfare of the people, their health, their housing, their schools, their jobs, their civil rights and their civil liberties, someone who believes that we can break through the stalemate and suspicions that grip us in our policies abroad, if that is what they mean by a liberal, then I'm proud to say that I'm a liberal.
How long has it been since we've had a president, or for that matter, a politician, who is willing to say, I'm proud that I'm a liberal? Well, I'll say it. I'm proud that I'm a liberal. Anyhow, we have on the table here, evolution, intelligent design. John Edwards has just tossed his hat into the ring. He's running for president as a Democrat. The fact that Castro, Raul Castro and Juan Almeida seem to be throwing olive branches in the air, and the Bush administration has absolutely no interest in catching them. All sorts of strange stuff going on. 1-866-440-8466. Mike in Elizabethtown, New York. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm a big fan. Living for a few years. I like your books a lot, too. I had a question about elections in 2008. Honestly, I live in a district in upstate New York where there's no real strong Democratic candidate, and I kind of wanted to get involved and possibly even run myself, but I didn't know where to start, and that's what I need to know.
The place to start is your county Democratic Party, or if there's a smaller local, you know, a precinct or whatever, but typically it's a county, and you've call the state Democratic headquarters, and if you can't easily find that number, call any Democratic politician in the state and ask them. Contact your state Democratic headquarters. Find out when and where your county party meets, who's in charge. Invite the person in charge out to lunch and, you know, sit down with them. Go to a couple of meetings, get to know the people, and then bring as many friends as you can in, and infiltrate and take over the local Democratic Party.
That's a pretty good idea. So just basically get involved, get a lot of people involved, and get people to listen, and
that's right.
Take it from there.
Yeah,
oh,
yeah,
okay.
And take it from there. It is a small D democratic process. I mean, if you have good ideas, if you present them well, if you speak well, and you're representing the values and ideas and thinking of the district, then, you know, you'll end up an elected official, and if not, if you're a little behind the curve, then, you know, well, there you are. If you're way ahead of the curve, you know, folks like Dennis Kucinich, then what happens is you become, even if you don't become, like, you didn't become president, you still become one of those people who shifts the curve. You become,
right,
you know, a strange attractor, to use the language of quantum physics or whatever. It's you pull the things in your direction. I think that's a great thing. Mike,
yeah.
good on you, and best of luck to you. Thank you for calling. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick.
Good day, Tom. Actually, I did happen to catch your book in the bookstore this last week. I was surprised you were into that subject. But
which book?
The one on the, were you just talking to your
Oh, Ultimate Sacrifice, about the assassination of Jack Kennedy. Yeah, it's really about a lot more than just Jack Kennedy.
Right, I understand. It's just a very thick book, and I...
Yeah, it's 900 and some odd pages.
Maybe some future show you can talk about it at length. But what I want to talk about was this recording that came out of President Ford, who just passed away.
Yes, with his interviews with Bob Woodward.
Coming out quite strongly. Now, I don't want to speak ill of poor Jerry since he's gone, but wouldn't that have been a lot better if that would have been released while he was still alive?
Yeah, except that he would not allow that. I mean,
he
was willing to have the interview with Bob Woodward on this. There's this kind of unspoken, well, actually, I think it's probably been spoken, but nonetheless, there's this kind of contract among past presidents that you don't diss other past presidents. And Jimmy Carter has actually broken that and been strongly, strongly criticized for it. By other past presidents, but basically, you know, they kind of keep, and particularly of your own party. I mean, you know, here you have Jerry Ford, who's a Republican, and was until the day he died. He's not going to diss another Republican president.
But it seems to me that the welfare of the country should come above partisan politics.
Yeah, you would think so. And probably in some way, at some level, Jerry Ford rationalized that the good of the country was best served by presidents not trashing presidents, by there being less chaos at that level.
But
you and I think, would agree that he should have spoken out earlier.
It might actually be more effective now because they can't speak ill of the dead.
Yeah, it may be. It may be. I mean, we'll see how it plays out. The Washington Post is certainly, right there on the front page. So,
right.
Rick,
okay.
Thanks a lot. And thanks for listening on WTKG there in Grand Rapids, Clear Channel in Grand Rapids. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Thanks to Walt in Fairport, New York, who called and shared with Lauren, who's screening calls for us in New York City, the quote from Albert Einstein, published in the New York Times in 1930, "Science without religion is lame. Religion without science is blind." And I've been groping about the distant recesses of my memory for that through most of today's discussions and never got to it, but it's great. Thank you. Before we go back to your calls, let's just take just one quick moment here and take a look at and listen to or whatever, check out what's happening with the ongoing occupation of Iraq.
I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the one to fight and to die. And there are lives in the balance.
Following our security developments in Iraq as of 0945 Greenwich Mean Time on Thursday, compiled by Reuters, Dateline Baghdad, a car bomb exploded at a petrol station near the Shaab Stadium in central Baghdad, killing 10 people and wounding 25. In Baqaba, gunmen killed a police captain and wounded two other policemen in a drive-by shooting in Baqaba. In Baghdad, two roadside bombs exploded in Bab el-Sharji in central Baghdad, killing 7 people and wounding 35. In Hawija, a roadside bomb targeting an Iraqi police patrol wounded 3 policemen. In Yusufaya, Iraqi special forces backed by U.S. advisors have captured an al-Qaeda cell leader believed to be behind the kidnap in June of 2 U.S. soldiers who were found tortured and dead, according to the U.S. military. In Baghdad, a total of 51 bodies were found on Wednesday in different districts of Baghdad overnight. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb exploded near a U.S. military patrol, killing 2 soldiers and wounding another on Wednesday. In Baghdad, a roadside bomb detonated near near a U.S. military patrol, killing 1 soldier and wounding 2 other soldiers on Wednesday. And near Mahmoudiya, U.S. and Iraqi army troops arrested 30 suspected insurgents southwest of Mahmoudiya, 30 kilometers south of Baghdad, according to the U.S. military. And, of course, Jerry Ford speaking from the grave, an interview he gave to Bob Woodward several years ago on the condition that it not be released until after he was dead, criticizing George W. Bush for attacking Iraq, for the war in Iraq, saying he would have used diplomacy, criticizing Dick Cheney, saying he has a fever, echoing the reference to this war fever that apparently Cheney has,
criticizing and saying that he was dumbfounded when he learned of Bush's domestic spying program, illegal domestic spying program. I mean, this is exactly what Nixon did. So, by the way, folks in our chat room indicating that it sounded, apparently, with our last caller, like I was defending Jerry Ford's decision to do that. I certainly didn't mean to defend that, if that's what you took away from it. I was trying to understand his thought process. But, you know, I think he should have, if he believed that something was wrong, he should have said so at the time. I agree with the folks in the chat room who are saying, hey, country before party. Absolutely. Neil in Kirkland, Washington. Hey, Neil, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. It's great to have you live here in Seattle, and we sure appreciated seeing you in Town Hall.
Well, thank you.
Great. You know, this idea of the red deer that you spoke of at Town Hall can really tie into the whole question of intelligent design or creationism at its core, because take the work of, say, Brian Swim, a book about 20 years ago called The Universe is a Green Dragon, which essentially the universe is a mystery, something a little bit unknowable, but it appears that matter and consciousness are two sides of the same coin. You know, yes. They both came as a package.
Well, that's my belief. In fact, my belief is that matter derived from consciousness, that consciousness preceded matter. But that's just my personal, you know, epistemology.
Great. And at the core of that, you know, you'll find like the yoga, which is the union of spirit and matter and in consciousness, but also this idea that, well, if there is matter in consciousness, then it's sort of democracy at its core. Everything has life. Everything is alive. And each one of us has our own inherent spirituality, not imposed from above, from a government system or from a spiritual or religious institution, but our own. And from that, we derive our freedoms and we derive our own sense of innate consciousness. And if any of us can grasp the idea of infinity, which is a big one, then there appears, creation. Well, was there a beginning? Was there an end? I mean, I don't have any answers necessarily, but I still sure have a lot of questions. So,
it's all pretty.
Go ahead.
Yeah, well, thank you, Neil, for your comments. It's all pretty boggling, isn't it?
It keeps us all asking the same questions every day. I'm just pleased to have the question. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thanks a lot for the call. Yeah, my sense of it is if you can break an atom, if you take an atom is made out of electrons, protons, and neutrons, and electrons, protons, and neutrons are made out of leptons, you know, the quarks and whatnot. They're made out of muons. You get smaller and smaller particles until finally you get particles that are indistinguishable from packets of energy. They're basically measured in photons. And my belief, I'll put it right out, this is a belief system. I don't have evidence for this. My belief is that that energy, just like matter is made out of energy, and the amount of energy it takes to produce a given quanta of matter can be calculated. The energy necessary to create a piece of matter is equal to the mass of that matter times the speed of light squared, E equals mc squared. Just as matter is made out of energy, I believe that energy, which is the stuff that makes matter, that energy is made out of consciousness, that the finest, you know, as you break, or that the most subtle form of energy, let's say, that would be a better way of saying it, that, you know, there's coarse energy, you know, sound, motion through air, light. And then you get these subtler and subtler, finer and finer levels of energy. And I think the finest, most subtle level of energy is consciousness, in my opinion. Evan in Durham, North Carolina. Hey, Evan.
Yay. Hey, let me see. What I wanted to do was just direct your attention to this movie that's out now, which is has Will Smith in it. It's called The Pursuit of Happiness.
I have not seen it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. It is, it's a very interesting movie in that, it's the story of this guy, Chris Gardner, who's a millionaire at this point. And, it goes back to the early 80s when he was, you know, pretty much dead broke and didn't have a dime.
Mm-hmm.
The movie goes into what was Jefferson actually thinking when he placed that pursuit of happiness, into the Declaration of Independence. And because, you know, this is more of a rags to riches sort of story.
and it's about the struggle, very intense struggle that Will Smith as Chris Gardner goes through. There's a lot of stuff in there about the pursuit of getting into how do you get into the middle class and who is holding the keys to get in there. There's something subtle about race relations in there because this is Dean Witter that this guy actually ended up working for. And there are also some, the only thing about it that kind of threw me is that the corporation is, in a sort of a subtle way, is the hero. I mean,
ouch.
Because it was the corporation that gave him the job.
Yeah, well, and also, you know, one of the things that Jefferson was very much about was not that the pursuit of happiness was the pursuit of wealth. In fact, he wrote about how we had to have laws of taxation that would prevent any person from ever becoming so wealthy that the power of that wealth would endanger the power of democracy, the power of the state.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've obviously kind of blown that one. But interesting. I'll have to check the movie out.
Yeah, and corporation issue. I mean, the corporation is not the hero of the film, and it's more about how do you achieve this American dream.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a good one. That's a good one. Evan, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. And you know, yeah, the American middle class is the American dream. The American dream is not to become Bill Gates. The American dream is to be the middle class, to be in the middle class. And it's slipping through our fingers. David in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, David.
Yes, hi. This is not actually what I called about, but I couldn't help noticing that quote from Kennedy that I never heard before. He could have said that yesterday. I mean, it's so, you know, eerily relevant to now, but anyway, the reason I called, you know, on the, you know, the evolution and creationism, which I call design now, there's a fascinating book that I started reading. I mean, I tend to think very scientifically, too, but this really gives you pause for thought. It's called The Science of God. It's written by Gerald Schroeder, who is both a physicist, you know, MIT physicist, and a biblical scholar.
Mm-hmm.
And he makes a very good, so far I can see, a very good attempt at reconciling, you know, biblical accounts beneath the surface, you know, beneath the literal Bible, and scientific observation.
That's fascinating. I'll have to keep an eye out for that. David, thank you very much for the heads up on that. I find, for example, Elaine Pagel's work to be brilliant. She writes about, you know, essentially mysticism and the core of mysticism, the nature of mysticism in Christian history, and there are others in other religions that I've read as well. It's all fascinating stuff to me. But anyhow, 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Cause in another lifetime, one of toil and blood, when blackness was a virtue, when the road was full of mud, I come in from the wilderness, a creature void of form. Come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm.
And welcome back. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. Tom Hartman here with you, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Bonnie in Burkittstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. You were talking about a line, "We are stardust," in a song, a Joni Mitchell song.
Yeah.
Well, it's also in a Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song about Woodstock.
Yeah. In fact, I think it may be the same song. But
yeah, we are stardust, we are golden, and getting back to the garden, all that.
Yep.
But my question is, if a desire for democracy is in our DNA, like you said, and I believe that, then why are there such a significant number of people in need of a strong, strict leader? For example, no matter what W does, he has that 30% adoring following, and although he's not Hitler, but there's some parallels. Hitler was always campaigning and running for election. He managed to get one-third of the vote in one of his elections.
Right.
And that's nothing to sneeze at. So, esplenit dumitumas.
Sure. First of all, if you have a population of rats that are living together harmoniously in a lab, but a large enough lab environment that each has its own space and all that kind of thing, and you start, and this is experiments done, you know, Psych 101 back in the 50s and 60s, and you start diminishing the size of the environment,
without reducing the population of the rats. So you're now having increased population density. You will hit a certain threshold where those rats will begin to kill each other. And yet that's not normal behavior for rats, where they will begin to eat their young. And yet that's not normal behavior for rats. I would submit to you, Bonnie, that the normal state of human beings, I agree with Rousseau on this and not Thomas Hobbes, to take this back to the 1600s, the natural state of humans, of you know, mankind, humankind, whatever you call it, is to live harmoniously and democratically in an egalitarian society. And when our population pressures or resource pressures become great, then survival mechanisms kick in that cause aberrational behavior, such as dominator cultures, for example. And that an awful lot of what we're seeing right now is the consequence of this incredible population explosion that accompanied the agricultural revolution about 10,000 years ago. Because you, by and large, you don't see this among indigenous and aboriginal people who have stable populations and don't live an agricultural life, but instead live a hunter-gatherer life. Dan Quinn is probably the most eloquent writer on that topic, although there's a lot about that in my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and in the book, Man's Rise to Civilization. I'm forgetting the author's name now, it's out of print, but it's the book that laid out a lot the Shoshone information that I have that's in Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. So I think what you're seeing with that 30% are people whose psyches have been distorted, as it were, by modern civilization and culture. Make sense?
Yes, well then, can that be like a learned behavior over the past 10,000 years since we've been, I think, an invasive species on the planet?
Well, I think it might even be genetic, just like with rats. I mean, obviously they are programmed at a certain point when their population density reaches a certain threshold to reduce that population, even if it means violence.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I think learning is also carried over physically and passed on
Well. There's that. Whether it's nature or nurture, I don't know.
Right.
You know, it would just be speculation. But I think that the dominator cultures and dominators, you know, this whole what George Lakoff describes as the strict father mm-hmm. model, is adaptive, but it's maladaptive. It's semi-maladaptive. It's adaptive to a maladaptive culture. And that the changes that we need to make fundamentally are at the level of our culture, rather than, you know, blaming the individuals. But anyway, mm-hmm. that's just my theory on it. Bonnie, thank you for the call.
That's a good explanation.
Okay, good
Bye-bye.
Talking to you. Doug in Staten Island, New York. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind today?
Good afternoon. It's nice to talk to you again, Tom. I was just listening to the whole discussion, and I just want to just keep something in just on the top of the agenda, if I can,
sure.
That when we mention word, you know, the vernacular is important. The other wordsmiths on the other side have managed to poison the vernacular with social, public, community, etc. Really has been dumbed down. We have the clear forests, which are basically just logging roads into ancient forests. We have healthy skies, rather clear skies, which are going to clear the skies of birds, I guess. And we have all these policies. And when you say design, it lends a certain credence to it when you introduce it into the vernacular and say, well, it's a design. We have to remember there's a gentleman by the name of Dr. Leon Cass. He's out of the University of Chicago. He's chairman of the Bush's Bioethical Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched this gentleman many times. I have him on tape. He is fanatical beyond his thin veneer. He has written and he has stated several times, quote, science is fundamentally incompatible with civil society because science is loyal only to truth and promotes novelty. Civil society requires submission to, and yes, even reverence for, authority.
Yes, that's that maladaptive worldview that Bonnie and I were just discussing. I think that he probably really believes that. Certainly that's what John Adams believed. It's what Alexander Hamilton believed. It's what Thomas Hobbes believed. I mean, you find people throughout history who believed that and used that as a rationalization for their behavior. Doesn't mean it's so.
Yeah, he compared using embryos that were going to be discarded as prematurely making a kidney donor or a liver donor out of a person who had 5 weeks to live in a discussion that he had at the College of Holy Cross on March 21st, 2005.
Yeah.
And when he tried to make a little joke of saying, well, you could go too far if you wanted to use a human embryo, would you inject it into a pig to keep it alive? And when he said, when some people said, yes, they would, he said, oh, you'd be giving it a pig for a mother. And when they got upset, he said, quote, if I've offended anybody in the audience, please, please forgive me. All glory to people on the pro-life side, because they stand for something in this matter. All glory to God.
This is Bush's head science guy. Amazing. Doug,
yeah.
Thank you very much for the heads up on that. I'm sorry, we've got to wrap up the show. We'll be back tomorrow. Senator Bernie Sanders will be here answering your calls during the first hour, our regular Brunch with Bernie segment. Helen Krebel and I will be arguing about immigration. And in the last hour, we will once again be writing a book on the air, live, Cracking the Code, the Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.